to Eurovision, a podcast series that explores the extractivist gaze of European institutions and policies as a way to look beyond these extractive practices to the possibility of thinking and doing otherwise. My name is Audrey Sanson, part of the artist duo Fraud.
With myself, Francisco Gallardo, and in our practice, we invested in building critical spatial literacy.
In this case, into the inscriptive operations of the EU's Critical Raw Materials Initiative. In the previous episode, we considered the importance of the Berlin Conference in the genealogy of extraction between the European and the African continent with Professor Adebaju. In the following episode, we will consider how the very foundation of the EU was predicated upon this extractivist model. In their book, Eurafrica, the Untold History of European Integration and Colonialism, P.O. Hansen and Stefan Jonsson debunk the theory of what they refer to as the immaculate conception of the European Union formation, one where a group of benevolent Western European leaders chose to set aside nationalist rivalries to unite for peace, democracy, and freedom, to one where the cooperation of European states to no little extent was predicated upon the exploitation of African resources, which could be better accomplished through a coordinated effort. Thus, according to Hansen and Jonsson, the concept of uniting the original six Western European states was itself predicated upon the extraction of resources across the African continent, and, I quote, indispensable for Europe's geopolitical and economic survival, end quote. We believe that the genealogy of Eurovision partially stems from Eurafrica, which is why this work has been so important to our project, and we're therefore, of course, very happy to have the opportunity to discuss these questions with the authors directly. And with this, I shall begin with our first question for you today. In your book, you outline how the Eurafrican project is about association with the member states' colonies rather than inclusion, which is exemplified in how Eurafrica extracts resources from Africa while blocking freedom of movement for Africans. In other words, resources flow into the European continent while people cannot. Can you explain certain examples where elements to impede migration were specifically discussed and implemented in the European integration negotiations, and how this important distinction between association and inclusion is perpetuated in Europe today?
What happened in 1957 was that France's and Belgium's colonies were associated to the European Economic Community. With the exception of Guinea, their association would continue also after their independence, as agreed in the 1963 Yaounde Convention between the European Economic Community and 18 newly independent African countries. Association, whether colonial or post-colonial or neo-colonial, mainly involved matters of trade and investment. And there is widespread agreement among researchers that the EEC's and subsequently the EU's association regime with Africa has worked in the favor of European interests. In short, it has perpetuated relations of dependency and African states' role as producers of raw materials. Development scholars noticed these problems already in the 1960s, and those African leaders and activists who advocated Pan-African post-colonial cooperation as a means to challenge European dependency. They had, of course, addressed the problem all along. As to the question of full inclusion of the French and Belgian colonies into the EEC, whereby colonial subjects would attain equal status with the metropoles and the colonial subjects equal treatment, This was never seriously considered. And it was impossible for the simple fact that they were colonies rather than independent states, and thus had no influence whatsoever on the negotiations that led up to their association with the EEC in 1957. As long as their populations were colonial subjects and not equal citizens, inclusion could not be a realistic question.
But there was one crucial exception to this, and that was Algeria, or the Algerian departments of France. For France, Algeria was not a colony, but an integral part of the Republic. And consequently, France made sure to include rather than associate Algeria into the EEC. And this, of course, raised all sorts of problems related to what we just mentioned. Because, as established by the French Constitution of 1946, which also established the Fourth Republic after the war, all Algerians were, formally speaking, French citizens or French nationals. So a full inclusion into the EEC thus struck right at the heart of the issue of full equal treatment for the Algerians within the EEC. This would include Algerians' right to free movement in the EEC, and hence their right to work and receive equal rights and treatment in any of the six member states. As we show in our book, however, the realization of such a scenario was never really contemplated amongst the six member states that negotiated. Instead, the consensus was that Algerians should be excluded from equal treatment and free movement. Nevertheless, to stipulate the outright exclusion of Algerians in the EEC treaty was a very sensitive matter for France. And so the Treaty of Rome had to be phrased in a way that did not make this too apparent, because an explicit exclusion would have necessitated what France refused, namely to have the treaty establish an equally explicit differentiation between French citizens in the metropole and those residing in Algeria. If undertaken candidly, a discriminatory differentiation of this type would have been in obvious contradiction with the French colonial myth and ideology. And it would have been particularly contradictory, we should add, at the time when the French government claimed to be doing its utmost not to exclude or discriminate, but rather to include and ensure the full equality of the Muslim so-called French citizens of Algeria, which was a new legal category created in 1956 specifically for the alleged purpose of rectifying the inequalities faced by Algeria's Muslims. So this formed part of Paris's strategy to win the war in Algeria and thus preserve Algeria's status as an integral part of France. Even though nominally French citizens, Muslim or non-European Algerians were still formally excluded, and this is very important to remember. They were excluded from several political rights, not to speak of the many forms of harsh racist discrimination and social deprivation that they were subjected to, and which thus made a mockery of their formal so-called French citizenship or French nationality. So indeed, the migration and free movement issues were very much discussed when the EEC was founded in the 1950s. And it was, to some extent, discussed in a similar way as it is today. Now as then, the EU is reaping the benefits of its favorable and unequal access to African resources, and now as then, it wants to ensure control over migration from Africa. But this does not mean, as is commonly assumed, that the EU wants to stop African labor migration. What it wants is to ensure unequal treatment. Hence, to study today's EU migration policy is also in part to study Eurafrica's colonial legacy of unequal relations between the European Union on the one side and the African colonies and countries on the other.
Which nicely brings me to our next question, which you've already started to explain, which is how is the notion of Eurafrica still relevant today, and how are economic developments and political negotiation further strengthening this legacy of African states as raw material providers.
Yes, as I already noted, EurAfrica is still very relevant today. The structure of EurAfrican Association that was erected by the EEC's colonial association in 1957 is still partly in place. If we are to grasp today's unequal relations, we need to know how things started off in the 1950s, an era of explicit colonial domination. To be sure, EU leaders do talk a lot about a partnership of equals today, the importance of African development, and all the aid and investment-related EU initiatives in place to facilitate this process. Yet, the asymmetric and unequal division of labor, production, and trade is still the most distinctive and resilient aspect of the current relationship between the EU and Africa. Also, the EU's global aspirations vis-à-vis Africa remain vigorous. In 2018, the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker launched the new Africa-Europe Alliance for Sustainable Investment and Jobs, which focused on a range of economic issues, but also on security and, as always, on measures to prevent irregular migration. The new European Commission that took office in December 2019 followed suit and pledged to make the EU's partnership with Africa its number one global priority. The new Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, wasted no time in going to work. Before her first 100 days in office had come to an end, she had not only visited the African Union's headquarters in Addis Ababa twice, she had also presented a brand new comprehensive strategy with Africa. The strategy document was prepared jointly with Josep Borrell, the EU's new High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. As Borrell emphasized when presenting the new strategy with Africa in 2020, he said, quote, "A part of Europe's future is at stake in Africa. To face our common challenges, we need a strong Africa, and Africa needs a strong Europe." End quote. It is this precise rhetoric of mutuality and interdependence between the two continents that permeates the EU's current relations with Africa. And as we show in our book, the same rhetoric was omnipresent in the discourse on EurAfrica from the 1920s to the 1950s, as it captured one of the key reasons adduced by the EU's founders for their decision to annex colonial Africa to the European project in the Treaty of Rome. What is good for Africa is good for the EU, and vice versa.
By aligning with Africa, the EU sees itself much better equipped to deal with Russia, Turkey, and China, with adversaries to the east in an uncertain multipolar world. The EU's geopolitical alliance with Africa, quote, "the largest voting bloc in the UN," unquote, invokes an image of an emergent force between east and west, running from north to south. In a headline in The Economist in 2018, this is referred to as, quote, "the rebirth of EurAfrica," unquote. And the journal continues, quote, "why Europe should focus on its growing interdependence with Africa," unquote. As the rebirth of EurAfrica denotes, The Economist argues that EurAfrica was part and parcel of the, quote, "Roman, Carthaginian, Moorish, and Venetian empires," unquote. Yet it fails to mention EurAfrica's most recent historical materialization, namely that of being an integral part of the European Union when it was founded in 1957. As the French daily Le Monde put it in the headline in 1957, "First step toward EurAfrica." This was the way in which it was seen when the European Union was founded.
It is indeed interesting that this so-called rebirth of EurAfrica appears to really depoliticize its context historically and its genealogy. So this brings us nicely to the following question, which is about a very tangible example of the EurAfrican extractive gaze, which came to life in Atlantropa. This vision, put forward by German architect Hermann Sergel between 1928 and 1952, essentially proposed an enormous land grab in the Mediterranean by lowering the sea level to create land to be cultivated, as well as huge dams to generate hydroelectricity. Atlantropa is often discussed as a marvel of engineering imagination, or as a delusion of grandeur in terms of ecological impact. However, it is rarely put forward as an exemplification of the establishment of infrastructures and epistemologies of extraction with third countries. And you use this as a powerful illustration of the concept in your book, along with other architectural visions of the time. So could you say something about the flow of energy and goods in the Atlantropa plan and others, and also how, despite Atlantropa itself never being built, how it has in some form materialized in different modalities throughout the continent?
Yes, I can. Hermann Sergel's Atlantropa is probably, or certainly, the most outrageous of all the blueprints for Eurafrica that circulated in the early to mid-1900s. For there were many similar models, especially in the 1920s and the 1930s. They all shared at least two traits. The first was a geopolitical reasoning that called for the resurrection of Europe as a power block in a historical situation when Europe saw both its global position threatened by the US and the Soviet Union and its racial superiority challenged by what was called at the time the rising tide of color. According to this reasoning, the geopolitical sphere of Eurafrica would be headed by a united Europe that would be sustainable and prosperous thanks to its incorporation of Africa. And correspondingly, the bonds between once antagonistic European states would be strengthened by their shared effort to develop, or rather exploit, Africa. The unification of Europe and the unified European effort in Africa would thus be processes that mutually presupposed one another. In short, Europe's unification would start in Africa. This was the first trait. The second trait indicated by this first one is that Eurafrica would enable large-scale extraction of resources. What distinguishes Hermann Sergel's Eurafricanist project, what he called Atlantropa, is therefore not the objective of extraction as such, but that he developed concrete plans for its realization through a daunting mobilization of technology and engineering that would dam the Mediterranean Sea, provide the hydroelectric power to all of Europe and Africa, and bring about the kind of political cooperation that was needed to extract Africa's subsoil minerals and agricultural produce. Sergel saw his own plan as far superior to all other Euro-African projects. The most influential of these were Richard Coudenhove Kalergi's plan for what he called Pan-Europe, which was supported by numerous top politicians and leading intellectuals of the era. Arguing for his project in terms of extraction, Coudenhove Kalergi constantly reminded his audience that Europe must unite in order to more efficiently exploit Africa. As he explained, quote, Africa could provide Europe with raw materials for its industry, nutrition for its population, land for its overpopulation, labor for its unemployed, and markets for its products, unquote. Extraction has remained a major argument for Eurafrica, from Sergel's and Coudenhove Kalergi's 1920s to the Rome Treaty up until our present. I will mention one example that brings this out. It's a document that we found in our research for our book. It is a text from December 1956, or more specifically, it is the preamble to a draft of the Rome Treaty articles concerning Association of the African Colonies. What emerges here In this quote, and in official language, is Europe's politics of extraction.
Economically speaking, the European member states of the common market have an essential need for the cooperation and support that the overseas territories, particularly the African ones, are able to offer in order to establish long-term balance of the European economy. The sources of raw material, variegated and abundant, which the overseas territories dispose of, are likely to ensure for the entirety of the European economy of the common market the indispensable foundation for an expanding economy and present the additional advantage of being situated in countries whose orientation may be influenced by the European countries themselves. In addition to the mineral riches of all kinds and the agricultural and exotic products of the overseas countries, it is fair to mention as a concrete incentive the results of very recent prospections in the petroliferous area carried out in connection with a systemic inventorying of the immense African reserves of metals, phosphates, and hydropower. End quote.
If what we hear in this quote was the official discourse, underlying it were myriads of small and large business investments and industrial initiatives. In this respect, the Eurafrican project boiled down to a French and Belgian need for foreign investments in various extractive projects in their respective colonies. This was an attractive opportunity, especially for West German companies. It is along this axis of French-Belgian-West German economic cooperation that we find the strongest and most central economic justification for the Eurafrican component of the EEC. Some coincidental events symbolize the high stakes of the Eurafrican project. For instance, on the very day of the signing of the Rome Treaty in late March 1957, the world press reported that a delegation of West German business leaders were invited by the French to look at opportunities in Algeria and French West Africa. A month earlier, the first ingot of aluminum produced from bauxite mined in Guinea was tapped from the French aluminum smelter in Edea, Cameroon, thus demonstrating to the world that huge wealth could be reaped through Eurafrican cooperation. We need only to note the aggressive European presence in today's Libyan oil fields, Ghanaian gold mines, Congolese mines, and elsewhere to understand that the Eurafrican business plan remains in place.
Thank you. And so I would like to finish by asking, with all this compelling research about the foundation of the EU in mind, how might we be propelled to think and do otherwise?
Well, this brings us back to the myth of the EU's immaculate conception, the peace project. So most basically, our book calls attention to the fact that also the EU project has a history, and that to think of this history in terms of a quest for peace, liberty, freedom, democracy, benevolence, and so on, is not at all to be thinking historically. Rather, it is to be nursing a myth. The scandal, of course, is that such mythical thinking still constitutes the normal approach to the history of the European Union. The official account of the historical EU-Africa relationship, that it is, in the end, reducible to a post-colonial affair, is still uncontroversial today among politicians at both EU and national levels, as well as among scholars. The awarding of the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize to the EU organization was ample testimony to this. Of course, the Norwegian Nobel Committee came under harsh criticism from international journalism for its choice. But the criticism mainly concerned the current state of the EU, and no criticism was leveled at the committee's main purpose, namely to celebrate and honor the original spirit that went into the founding of today's European Union in the 1950s. A headline in The Guardian typified the mood. Quote, "The EU's badly timed prize, The European Union might once have deserved its Nobel, but with the euro it has initiated an era of strife." End quote. From the headline, the article then went on to criticize the committee for being out of touch with today's realities. Yet at the same time, it emphasized that the award should be seen as, quote, "an important reminder that the European project has always had a strong element of anti-war idealism at its core," end quote. Commemorating the, quote, "real internationalism among the first European generation," end quote. This kind of disapproval actually had the effect of further solidifying the Brussels-promoted image of the EU's exceptional historical status and record.
In our book, we also explain that the credibility of such assertions have always presupposed that history is continually and permanently evaded. Historians of Europe and the EU have often contributed to this distortion, as they have held European integration at arm's length from the dirty business of geopolitics. Scholars have often failed in the historical examination of the global ramifications of European integration. Therefore, they have also failed to interrogate the role of European integration in global affairs. In part, this can be explained as the outcome of an original and erroneous conception of European integration that we take to task in this book of ours.
Because after all, the so-called peace project commenced in one of the post-war era's bloodiest wars, the Algerian War. That war raged on EU soil since the oil and gas-rich Algerian departments of France were fully incorporated into the EEC in 1957. Yet, did the European peace project do anything to stop the war, to stop the slaughtering of hundreds of thousands of mostly Algerian people, the systemic torture, the massive forced relocation and concentration camps? No, it did not try to stop this. By including Algeria into the EEC, the Treaty of Rome also, and crucially, reinforced Paris' claim that Algeria indeed was an integral part of France, and by the same token, lent legitimacy to France's war. Thus, thinking otherwise about the EU and its history should begin with the acknowledgement of the mythical nature of the peaceful unification which underpins the EU.
Thank you for detailing the European integration project's roots in extractivism and the concept of Eurafrique or Eurafrica. And we really hope that this episode will help to elucidate the myth of Europe's peaceful union, and therefore to support thinking otherwise than from this extractivist Eurafrican model that continues today. Thank you.
Eurovision. Eurovision was commissioned by Arts Catalyst and Radar and developed in collaboration with the Istanbul Design Biennale. Eurovision has been generously supported by the Canada Council for the Arts, Arts Council England, and Action Culturelle Española.